You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On Thursday, April 4th, 2013, Christy Coleman presented the fifth lecture in our six-part Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. It's the spring of 1862, and over 100,000 Americans are already dead, and the slaughter that is the Civil War is about to begin again. On January 1st, 1863, and ignoring the advice of his advisors, President Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation Executive Order. Listen as Ms. Coleman explains how this document took shape 150 years ago and why it's still important today. Christy Coleman was raised in Williamsburg, Virginia. She received her bachelor's and master's degree from Hampton University. Ms. Coleman began her career as a living history interpreter at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation while still a college student. She rose to the ranks to become the director of African American Interpretations and Presentations. It was during this time that she and her team gained international acclaim for their bold and evocative programming. She has served as president and CEO of the nation's largest African American museum, the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History, in Detroit. In 2008, she accepted the position of president and CEO of the American Civil War Center at historic Tredegar. She has lectured extensively and consulted with some of the country's leading museums, written several articles for scholarly and public history publications, as well as being an award-winning screenwriter for educational television. Her most recent work, Freedom Bound, won an Emmy in 2009 for outstanding educational programming. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. During the Q&A portion of the program, Ms. Coleman explains the rationale behind the Colonial Williamsburg Slave Auction that brought her national attention in 1994. Our podcast is entitled In the Cause of Liberty, African Americans and the Civil War. Here's Christy Coleman.
Thank you all very much for the opportunity to join you. Bring this down so you can hear me better. Right at my mouth. Oh, well, you know what? Then I think I'm going to have to carry it to talk, because I'm usually not the kind of speaker that stands behind the lectern. I like my presentations to be engaging and interactive, and Rick asked me to talk with you all about the Emancipation Proclamation and the importance of that document. And I'm excited to do so because this is the 150th anniversary of that document, officially January 1st. But it was a document, as you can imagine, that was, quite controversial for so many reasons. So let's wind the clock a little bit. I'm not going to wind it too far. I'm just going to take the clock back to the spring of 1862. Now, the spring of 1862. Well, you know, by May 1st of 1862, already 118,754 soldiers were dead. 1 year of fighting, over 100,954 people are dead by May 1st. It's the spring, so guess what? The slaughter is about to begin again. And I'm sure several of you in this room can begin to lay out what that next sequence of battles and activities were. Now, politically, in Washington, there was something else that was happening. There were things that were happening in the field, as a matter of fact. Because of the actions of these 4 million people who were enslaved were beginning to severely impact, and I don't know if severely is the correct word, were beginning to significantly impact federal forces. Why? Because as soon as the Union armies were showing up, enslaved people were running to those forces. And this was a problem. Because the military wasn't prepared to do anything with them. They didn't know what to do with them. And there's this interesting fellow by the name of Benjamin Butler, who was the commander at Fortress Monroe at the time. And Ben Butler was a brilliant lawyer. Kind of like this when it came to being a military leader, but in terms of an attorney, he was sharp as a tack. And Ben Butler had no problem figuring out what to do. In fact, Ben Butler goes beyond the First Confiscation Act. Now, the First Confiscation Act had been released, and the First Confiscation Act basically says, you know, if you're coming into an area, you may seize the property as you, you know, to be used for the war effort, or if it had been used against you, what have you. Well, Ben Butler has these three African-American men who escape from the trench works that they had been assigned to because the Confederacy was using slave labor. So I have to take this little side trip because people often ask me, well, weren't there black Confederates? And I'll get into greater detail about that, but the Confederacy was absolutely using black labor to build fortifications, to build canals, to build armament at Tredegar. They were part of the workforce at Tredegar. So these three men escape, cross over to Fort Monroe, and land there and say, we want asylum. And Ben Butler thinks about this for a minute. And of course, his junior officers are telling him, well, no, 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 we have to send them back. You know, we can't take them. And Ben Butler said, wait a minute. Let's think about this for a minute. The South considers these people property. This property is being used to advance the Confederacy. Therefore, I shall confiscate this contraband of war. And it sends ripples. Because you see, black people, then in particular, the tradition, the oral tradition, was still extraordinary. So word and news could travel fast and accurately. Remember that little game we used to play where you whisper into the person's ear? Well, back then, they would have got it right across 100 people. We can't get it past 5. Right? And so word quickly spread. And within a couple of months, Fort Monroe already has close to 10,000 runaways that are at Fort Monroe within a couple of months. So what does Butler do? He uses them to support the army, right? Now, again, this creates a problem because other military leaders, other generals on the federal side of the house, well, they're not quite sure what to do. Now, Sherman is thinking this might not be a bad idea, but I really don't want to take on the extra burden. I got a lot of ground to cover, right? But there are others who are thinking this might not be a bad idea. Meanwhile, Abraham Lincoln and his cabinet are furious by this action. Any ideas why Lincoln would be upset by this? Speak up.
South and North.
South and North. What's the challenge of accepting runaway slaves as contraband? Abolitionism is part of it. The problem is the contraband of war ideology, the practice of all of this, is really based on the one thing that Lincoln did not want to do, and that was recognizing the Confederacy as a separate government. Okay? Problem number one. Problem number two is tied to abolitionism, because even when he was elected, and we, Lincoln said even before he was elected, even when he was elected, I believe that as president, I can do nothing about the institution of slavery where it stands. I cannot constitutionally touch it. But he was in a new party. Brand new party that had its extreme to the right and it had its extreme to the left. It's extreme to the right, where very conservative folk who did believe in stronger central government believed very much that, you know, we will keep this thing from spreading and all will be well. Will the new territories that are opening up, it we'll just let those be free states. We'll let those be free soil. Let men go there to build lives for themselves. Slavery stays where it is. To the far left of this new Republican Party were the social radicals, the abolitionists. And even within them, there were wide swings. The least was, let's just end slavery, be done with it, and we can colonize these newly freed people out of the country because there's no way we'll ever be able to live together. So let's do that. Okay? Liberia, right? Very good, very good. Now, the other side of that was, oh, no. Those truly radical abolitionists, it wasn't just about ending slavery for them. It was about equal protection under the law, that this had to be extended to the newly freed. It had to, because our Declaration of Independence swore it. Our Bible swore it, that all are equal under God. And our Declaration of Independence, our document of our ideals of this new democracy, said all men are created equal by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. So for the radical abolitionists within the Republican Party, that was their goal. Now in the South, when this Republican Party rose up, the only people they heard was that fraction over there that said abolitionism and equal protection under the law, and my God, they're going to give Negroes the right to vote, which is a problem in the South. Why? Because there's so many. There were so many. As a matter of fact, that was the grand compromise that put our country on the map. The famous Three-Fifths Compromise. We were able to forge this Constitution after our Articles of Confederation failed miserably. When we came back to the table, that's the states' rights one. The central government was so weak that nothing could be done, that the states held all the power. It didn't work. We tried that. It failed. So we got a new constitution. And to get this new constitution passed, we compromised, because the South had then about 3 million African Americans, who made up almost 40% of the population, and in some areas made up 70% of the population. So we have a ruling elite, we have working poor, whites. We have a society where that's hierarchical, that's class, very much class-based. And not that this doesn't exist in the North, it's very different. And so clearly there are, the societies just evolved differently, North and South. They just did. In the North, there was a rise in this notion of free labor. All of the people that were screaming free labor, it wasn't necessarily that they had any interest in what happened to black people. Far from it. They simply did not want to compete with what they considered to be unfair labor. I can't go somewhere where slavery exists and earn a decent wage. It's that simple for them, right? I'm telling you all of this backstory for a reason. Because Lincoln is sitting there in Washington with Benjamin Butler now having granted essentially de facto recognition to the Confederate government. He is taking in runaway slaves, and runaway slaves are showing up at military encampments throughout the country. And Lincoln doesn't know what to do. But this Republican-controlled House says, okay, well, then we need a second confiscation act. And so they pass that. In the meantime, Lincoln spends the summer trying to negotiate, trying to figure out what he can do to lessen this problem. So one of the things that he does is he just starts having these little meetings. Lincoln, you know, if you have not had the opportunity to read Team of Rivals, I highly suggest it, because it really gets into the mind of this self-taught man who was a political genius. He really was. And he could do dirt. I mean, he was not beyond doing a backroom deal if it needed to get it done to what he considered to be the higher good. He wore the white hat, or at least he wanted to wear the white hat. But he didn't mind getting in the mud if he had to, right? As long as the hat didn't get dirty. Lincoln is an interesting person. So he spends the summer talking to his colleagues and saying, okay, so this has happened. What do we do about it? Do we grant abolition? How do we make this work? How do we deal with the border states? We don't want them to now leave the Union and go to the Confederacy over the issue of slavery. What do we do? How do we manage this? Is the answer to set up the colonies, to continue to plan for that, get the ships ready, do what we need to do because, you know, it's going to be an issue. How do we do that? Meanwhile, in the Confederacy, there is ongoing problems because not only are they trying to keep their new government running, they're trying to run their government in the midst of war, and they're trying to maintain their economic power. One of the things that people forget is that the South controlled 90% of the world's cotton market. They had wealth, they had international power and recognition. And if slavery ended, if they couldn't expand that market into new territories westward, it would stifle them. So there was also within the Confederacy consideration of when we get our independence, we can go south into Mexico. We can seize Mexico. We can take over Mexico. And that will be a part of the Confederacy as well. How many of you knew that? Rick raises his hand. Okay? So they're trying to export, you know, through hook or by crook, that cotton. Meanwhile, European markets are looking at this stuff and saying, you know, it's a real mess over there. Most of Europe is choosing to watch, wait and see. Even though they're talking to everybody, they're talking to all sides, they're kind of taking a wait and see because as the tensions were building, many in Europe were stockpiling the cotton that they needed for their mills and their production. And England even went a step further. England started testing raising cotton in its colonies in Egypt and India as a backup plan that the South never recovered from. Our finest cotton in the world comes from? So, Lincoln also says, well, one of the other things that groups that I might want to talk to in the midst of all of this is, in fact, the free black population. And there were a number of prominent free blacks, particularly in Philadelphia, in Boston, in New York, and in Ohio.
You know, what was the last
place? Ohio. And Lincoln brings this group of men, about 50, to Washington to meet with him. Among those men at that meeting was Frederick Douglass. And Lincoln says, now, if we propose to abolish slavery, I am really counting on the men of this room. You are educated, you have businesses, you have means. But you all know, even with all that you have done, that you will never be considered equal. Many of you do not even have the right to vote in this country as it stands, despite everything you've done. So don't you think it's best for you to serve as leaders of a new country someplace else? You can imagine what they said to him. Frederick Douglass in particular, wrote a scathing editorial in his paper. Basically called Lincoln everything but a child of God, and how could you possibly think that we would go anywhere? We helped build this country too. It is our blood in that soil. It is our labor that built the houses. It is our labor that built the house you live in. It was true. So Lincoln left that meeting not with the support that he had hoped to get. See, he was trying to figure out what to do with everybody, because the pressure was mounting within his party. People were changing. And then there were these new Democrats showing up. You know, the Democrats were trying to find a peace. They were trying to negotiate with the Confederacy. They were saying, well, look, if we can come to terms and end this war, then all will be right, and we can, you know, everything will go back to the way it was, and everybody will be happy. And they're like, no. William Seward about lost his mind behind that thought. So Lincoln ponders. And this is one of the things, to me, that marks a person of not only great intellect, but a person of even if their actions may be a little morally questionable, a person who is willing to step back and process and think and figure it out. Because even with all the things he was, to me, at the core of his being is a man of deep and abiding faith, a man who grew up with slavery. He understood it. He saw it. He didn't like it. But it was just the way it was. He recognized and acknowledged his own prejudices, his own fears. And yet, he said at the core, this is a person who also had famously said early in his term, the first term, if I could free all the slaves and save the Union, I would. If not a one was freed and we saved the Union, I would do that too. But by the summer of 1862, he's having a serious change of heart, as are a number of young soldiers who are making their way through the South, who for themselves are seeing this institution, which up to this point really had been presented fairly benignly. Because for most Northerners, they had no interaction whatsoever with black people. And their only representation of black people was through popular fiction, newspaper articles and stories, and our newspapers at the time were extraordinarily biased, and everybody knew it. They told you what their bias was in their headline, in their byline at the top. You knew whether you were reading a Whig paper, you knew whether you were reading a Democratic paper, you knew whether you were reading an abolitionist paper. They told you who they were and what they were. There's no questioning about that. And he's thinking. Processing. And he comes to what he thinks is a potential solution. But his cabinet again says he passes to them what's referred to as the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. And this preliminary document is quite interesting. It's full of compromise and caveats, recognizing the needs of the border states, recognizing the challenges within the Confederacy, recognizing the military issues that are taking place with soldiers in the field and these commanding officers that are trying to contend with and deal with all of these runaways. And his advisors tell him, do not issue this document. It will look like an act of desperation if you do. Do not issue an Emancipation Proclamation, because you haven't won anything yet. Not substantially. It's still essentially a draw. We push forward, they push back. They push forward, we push back. I won't even get into McClellan. I mean, McClellan, you all laugh. You know what I'm talking about. George B. McClellan was a Democrat. George B. McClellan, well, he was friends with all of these guys. Did you know that his wife actually wanted to marry A.P. Hill and her father wouldn't let him? And he makes this wonderful remark that every time he meets A.P. Hill on the field, he thinks he's not sure if it's because of the wife or it's because of the war. Why he comes at him so fiercely. McClellan, before he even came into an area, would literally send hand notes to plantation owners and farmers on his route in advance of his army to say, I'm not coming to take your property. I'm just here to fight the war. I'm not coming to bother you at all. The complete opposite of Sherman. Right? Sherman is war at all costs. We're at war. We're at war with everybody and everything. Fine. Completely different men. All of these men that are on both sides of this conflict, they know each other very well. These are West Pointers. These are men, the few men that actually served in this army before all of this unpleasantness began. Right? But Lincoln has to deal with McClellan. He's not happy with McClellan at all. Not just politically, but what he's doing on the field. McClellan will not make a decisive strike, and that's what Lincoln's advisors are telling him. We're going to have to either make a change down there on the peninsula. We're going to have to do something. We're not making the strides in there the way we need to. And Lincoln says, what do we do? He says, you just wait, because otherwise, again, it looks like desperation for you to say that you're going to free whatever slaves come into the army. Because, again, the Confiscation Act was just about taking them in. It wasn't really about freedom. It was just taking them in. The Emancipation Proclamation, or at least the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, was about granting freedom to those whose masters were in rebellion. And it exempted border states. And the slaves would have to prove that their owners were in rebellion. And it had all of these very interesting caveats. So finally, there's enough decisive action at the Battle of Sharpsburg or the Battle of Antietam, depending on what side of the line you're on. Since I've been working at the American Civil War Center, I have learned that sometimes battles have two names. So, Antietam was enough of a victory for Lincoln on September 22nd to issue this preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. The abolitionist community is absolutely outraged. William Lloyd Garrison in his Liberator paper go for the jugular. British observers in the papers there really call it the weakest thing they've ever seen. Because they were really waiting for some action. Because, of course, as you well know, Britain had already abolished slavery in its territories, right? Britain was, you know, out there with its grand ships stopping the pirating of Africans, of the transport of Africans into the Americas. I mean, they were blowing up these fortresses that were housing. They were serious about ending this. So for them to see this proclamation come out, it was almost laughable. And there was an interesting thing that was happening even within Britain, the different political units and powers that be in Britain, and it really was class-based in Britain. There were a lot of people that really wanted this young democracy to make it, that it didn't matter your station, that you could go and you could use your talents, you could use your wits, you could become whatever you wanted. That American dream was becoming very real to people in Europe, and they wanted the U.S. to succeed. So the Civil War to them, they watched and they wanted the federal powers to win. The ruling classes in Britain, however, were split. because of economic interests, and clearly behind their own systems of hierarchies, social hierarchy. So, Lincoln issues this document. Black folk hear about it. The numbers increase dramatically. There were already, by the time the emancipation, this preliminary Emancipation Proclamation had come out, there was already estimated over 120,000 African Americans had already run away and were already within Union lines. Even before this thing comes out, right? When it comes out, and this isn't the formal, this is the warning shot. That's the other thing, by the way, if you're not familiar with the Emancipation Proclamation. It was a warning shot. That document that was issued on September 22nd, 1862, was the warning shot. This is what we're going to do. We're going to give the Confederacy 100 days to come home, and everything will be fine. If you don't come home in this 100 days between now and January 1st, well, then we're just going to issue the proclamation formally. So it was a warning shot. Now you can imagine what the Confederacy said, right? Jeff Davis couldn't say it fast enough. Alexander Stevenson couldn't say it fast enough, and tons of other people. And then there was added to this, see, Lincoln is trying to destroy our whole system. Didn't we tell you when this all began that Lincoln was really about ending slavery? And, you know, all the things that he said meant nothing because this is what he meant. And then other people, I love Mary Chestnut. Have you ever read Mary Chestnut? Okay, so Mary Chestnut is talking about this, and Mary Chestnut writes in her diary that this proclamation is really an abomination, because what he is doing is he is leading our Negroes against us. Right? Turning them against us. They will kill us in our sleep. Memories of Nat Turner did not fade. And so there is a heightened reality. Remember when I said that the Confederacy was starting a new government and waging a war within that new government? There was another thing that the Confederacy was doing. The Confederacy had nationalized slave patrol and slave capture systems. The success of that is debatable. But they had to contend with this as well. So those men who were not of fighting age to be on the front lines would serve in these local slave patrols. And their job was to enforce the local slave codes and the like. And this was a problem. I mean, it was an extremely difficult thing to do. They were outnumbered in this task. So, so for 100 days, what do? We sit and we watch and we wait. Frederick Douglass decided, okay, it's not the way I wanted it. I know the Confederacy is not going to respond to this at all, so we have an opportunity here. And he gets together with William Lloyd Garrison and others, and they say, we need to start getting teachers, we need to start getting preachers, we need to start getting people together so that when these folks become free, because they will come, we need to be ready. We need to be able to help them transition to freedom. And they do. Where they're in New Bern, North Carolina, for example, they set up, there was a whole community that was set up there with schools for children and adults, teaching them reading and writing. In fact, that school became the sort of the bedrock of what would eventually become a very large free black community in New Bern, North Carolina. 1862, in the fall of 1862 and 1863. Yes. New Bern, North Carolina. right across from Fort Monroe, Shantytown. And as I said, there were already 10,000 people over there. and the number swelled again. So, in New Orleans, one was set up when New Orleans fell. In Natchez, Mississippi, another group. I mean, and think about the people that took this charge to go into the Deep South to do this work. Can you imagine what kind of courage and fortitude that took to go into clearly hostile area that could have changed hands again? Of course, the Confederacy said no, no deal. And on January 1st, Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation. But here's the thing. All of the caveats were gone. He allows the border states to establish their own system of abolition. He immediately ends slavery in Washington, D.C. as the federal district, slavery abolished immediately. That meant right away 50,000 plus people were now free. The bells that were ringing and the churches and the singing and the parades in the street were deafening, according to accounts of the day on January 1st when it's read in the public square. But there's one other thing that the Emancipation Proclamation did in its finality. It allows for these formerly enslaved men and for free black men who had wanted to when the war began but were barred from wearing the blue. It allowed them to be formally trained and serve as soldiers. Separate regiments were established called the United States Colored Troops. Over 180,000 men would serve. Another 20,000 would serve in the U.S. Navy on vessels. Another million of their wives and their children are now camp aid. That changes the course of the war. This Emancipation Proclamation, as much as it has been mocked and derided over time, even within the African American community, there used to be a time where Lincoln was a great hero in black families back in the basically from the end of slavery up until the early 1960s. And then he fell out of favor when people started really reading some of his early career and people started saying, well, the Emancipation Proclamation really didn't free anybody. It wasn't until the 13th Amendment that people actually got free. And it got all twisted. It got really, really twisted. And for the reunification to happen, the role that those men played and the self-agency that these formerly enslaved people had gets wiped from the story of the war. The narrative develops that the war was not to end slavery, that the South goes to war to preserve states' rights. Well, in the Confederacy's cornerstone documents, in its Constitution, it made clear. The military leaders in the Confederacy made clear why they were fighting at the beginning of the war. But in that reunion period up to like the 25th anniversaries when they all start getting back together and meeting on battlefields and reconciliations and all of that, it starts to shift. And it's interesting because in the North, a lie was told as well. In the North, the lie was, we went to war to end slavery. No, you didn't. They didn't. The North did not go to war to end slavery. The North went to war to save the Union. The Emancipation Proclamation is the document that shifts the war's aims. And in fact, several young soldiers were writing home saying, if they abolish slavery, if they make this war about slavery, I am going home. I will throw down my arms. I am done. And several did. But for those that made their way into Tennessee and into Virginia and the Carolinas and into Georgia, and they saw this institution firsthand, not the minstrelsy shows that they saw, not the articles that they read, because minstrelsy was all over the country. That was the most popular entertainment at the time. And one of the biggest, you know, stars of that was people putting cork on their faces and imitating black people. So the only, for many Northerners, their only idea of what black people were was what they saw in these shows. It's like people today thinking all black people are like the hip hoppers that wear their pants down here and they put the baseball cap on. That's not who we are. That's some of them. There's something wrong with them, clearly, but that's not who we are. It's a subculture. It is what it is. It's rebellious youth. It's I'm mad, I'm angry with the world. It's no different than Jim Morrison, you know? Exactly. Are those of you that snuck out, you know who I'm talking about. There are you in this room. I know you did it. You went and smoked that little funny thing back in the 60s. And you had your parties, or you did whatever you did. It's just, that's part of our young people's thing. And unfortunately, because that's what most people in the larger culture see, because it's so popular and it's so, you know, your grandkids are probably doing some of it and listening to some of it. For some people, that's what they think it is. And the similar idea is my point. It's a similar idea. So when these young men actually saw the deprivation and they actually saw children ripped from their mothers, when they actually saw that for themselves as they were making their way through, or seeing coffles of people that were being taken from Richmond, because Richmond was the second largest intrastate slave trading city in the country behind New Orleans. At least 50,000 people a year were born and bred and brought to Richmond and sold to the Deep South. One business, Lumpkin's Jail, one business. There were 40 slave auction houses in the Shaco region of downtown Richmond at the time. One of those, and he wasn't even the most wealthy, was Lumpkin's, Robert Lumpkin's. Robert Lumpkin's site, he did $4 million annually in slave trading. That's 1860 money. That's just one business. So this was a major commercial enterprise, buying and selling human beings. And in fact, most of the capital, this is the new research that's come out, I've been absolutely floored by it. The newest research, because there's been a lot of economic studies that have gone into this period, and the latest research that has come out has said that for the, you know, with this 90% cotton enterprise world market, that the South's primary capital of slaves was the largest industry in the country, outranking the value of the railroads, outranking the value of the steamship enterprises, and the mills. It was human beings, was the top capital. So when this war ends, of course, the South economically collapses, because all of its capital, or large portions of its capital, is tied up in human beings. Think about that for a minute. But I digress. The Emancipation Proclamation is what changes the tenor of the war for the North. It changes how we will choose to define freedom and how we will fight over that definition for the next 150 years. It is important. All of the steps that happened to get to that moment on January 1st were important. The people who were engaged in it, it's important. The now estimate from the original 620,000 that basically stood for 140 years of the numbers of people that died during the American Civil War, that number has been bumped to about 700,000. And that's not even counting peripheral damage. That's not even counting the people who come home maimed and wounded. That's dead. It is our greatest American trauma. And as a trauma, we all are at various stages of dealing with that grief. All of us. 150 years later. So part of what I like to do is I like to help people see it. Because our history is not, when we say, you know, history is, you know, we have to tell the whole story. Well, the whole isn't the circle. The whole is a sphere. It's all of that surface, and it's all of that that's in the middle. Because I assure you, there were 700,000 different reasons why people did what they did and made the choices that they made. Nobody had a moral victory or moral superiority in any of it. It was death, it was destruction, and we got very, very good at killing each other. And it was our first mass media war. We had the telegraph, we had photographs. We saw war every day. Remember what it was like when Vietnam was cast in your living rooms every day. Imagine that scale. There is nothing honorable in this. It wasn't. And all of the young men who were hoo-haing at the beginning, oh, off the war, valiant war, those same young men couldn't wait to get home. Desertions were high on both sides. It was horrible. The place where I work, Historic Tredegar, Joseph Reed Anderson and his team of engineers had patented some of the deadliest cannon you can imagine. We have a reproduction of one that we just recently acquired. It's a 20-pounder. We only use a half a pound of powder. This thing could propel, you know, 20-pound shot. It could carry it up to 4 miles. We use a half a pound of shot of black powder in this thing. To actually fire it in its heyday, you'd use 5 pounds of powder. Now, I invite you, when you have the opportunity, to come out and see us on a Saturday afternoon from 11:30 to 1 o'clock. If you want to see this thing fired and you want to see how it worked, and we let you actually, you know, get close to it and do the drill and all the different 8 people that will be required to fire this puppy. But it was devastating, and the sound is deafening with half a pound. Can you imagine 40 or 50 of these things lined up on the field going off? This is not fun. This is not glorious. This is death and destruction that were blowing people apart. So, when we remember, I encourage you to remember them all and all the stories about how we had to reforge our definition of freedom and what America would be with all of her shortcomings and all of her amazing, amazing realities to bring us to this point today. And on that, I'm going to leave the last 10 minutes for questions with you. Thank you so much. Yes, ma'am. I'll repeat the questions, by the way, so that everybody can hear. Yes, ma'am. The question is that during the war, she had heard that soldiers were told not to take other people's personal property and, you know, that sort of thing as they were making their way. And that just didn't work. I mean, they had armies to feed. They did it. They took it. They wrecked places. They took what they wanted. Some of them pillaged. I mean, quite frankly, the spoils of war is, unfortunately, a really old and nasty business. But it happened.
Lincoln told him
that. It didn't mean a squat. I mean, he was commander in chief, but it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. Yes, sir.
Because they're free.
Okay. What is the interplay between the groups? The question is asking, what did the black population think? How did they break down in terms of their interest in colonization, fighting in the war, what have you? Well, colonization had been tried several times in our nation's past. And it just was never an idea that flew. Part of the reason is and I use the term black population because Africa is a huge and diverse continent. And even though the majority of peoples were coming from Western and Central Africa, even within that, there are many different ethnic and cultural groups that amalgamated and become American black people. And so going back to some place made absolutely no sense because that's not where they were from. In fact, by 1860, you've got some people who are generationally into eighth, ninth generation American born enslaved. Okay? So colonization is really off the table. There are a few who actually do make this journey, but the numbers are small. And when I say small, I mean, okay, after the American Revolution, for those African Americans that joined up with British forces, and there was about 100,000 of them, actually a little bit more than that, because British did Lord Dunmore's proclamation right here in Virginia, that if their masters were rebelling against the crown, they could come to the British and be free, and the British would give them freedom. And the British honored that. I mean, that's... The British honored that promise. They had two major disembarkment points. Charleston, South Carolina lost 85% of its slave population in 1782 because of all the people that joined the British, got on those ships, and left. 85%. So it's no wonder South Carolina's a little crazy. I mean, they understood very well what it would mean to lose one slave population. They knew better than anybody else because it had already happened to them. If you're from South Carolina, please forgive me. I think it's a lovely state. New York was the other. New York Harbor was the other one. Huge numbers. Now, the people that disembarked, most of the ones who disembarked out of Charleston were either sent to Britain or they were sent to Sierra Leone, which was the British colony for recolonization. The others went to Nova Scotia. Horrible, horrible land in Nova Scotia. Right, can you imagine going from South Carolina to Nova Scotia? So that colony survived, and descendants are there to this day. But it was a hard survival. A lot of people died. Again, numbers outside of that disembarkment, that was probably the largest number of people leaving. There was another colonization attempt in the 1820s and 1830s. Even among those numbers, it's less than 20,000 people. So it's just not viable for so many reasons. Even if I leave, I am leaving behind. Even if I don't know where they are, I might know where they are. My daughter or my husband might be on a neighboring farm, or they're within a day's walk or whatever. I'm leaving those people behind, and I don't want to do that. So there are familial connections that are keeping people here. Now, there are clearly, I mentioned up to 1 million people who run away during the course of the war and join the forces. So that's 25% of the enslaved population that joins the Union forces, which means 75% didn't go anywhere. And there are a variety of reasons for that. Most of those reasons, when you look at the slave narratives from the period, why didn't you run? They didn't know who to trust. There had been a whole series of rumors and rumors on top of rumors about what would happen to you if you went to the Yankees. Right? So there was a concerted effort to keep people where they were. And so the feeling was, I'll just hang out till it's all done. They weren't sure who was going to win. They weren't sure what was going to happen if it ended, what was going to happen to them if they ended. So a lot of them stayed put. Even after their owners left, there were the places that you love to go golf, Hilton Head Island and all of that, were huge plantation establishments. And when the armies came in there, a lot of whites fled that area and went further inland or left the country or just went someplace else. So, and the slaves stayed on those properties and managed those properties. So when the war is over, many of them now own those properties, were given those properties. And then in the 1980s, because they were poor farmers and they were still doing what they did back up there in the woods, and people started building golf courses and resorts, and their property taxes went up, and guess what? They lost their land because they weren't protected against the rising cost of their taxes on lands that they had been on for 100+ years. So that's part of the story. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Rick opened the door and you've got to take us through. Tell
I will do my best.
Okay, we want to hear about the slave market that you
Okay. Actually, we didn't do slave auctions. Let's be clear. It wasn't plural. At Colonial Williamsburg, at that time, basically from the 80s into the mid-90s, actually through the 80s and the 90s, Colonial Williamsburg to me was one of the most compelling and creative and interesting places to visit and to work. We were going through a major transition. We were shifting, making the shift, and bringing in the stories of everyday people. Most of the visitors who came to Williamsburg had no idea at the height of the Revolutionary era that Williamsburg was 52% black. Its most important capital city was 52% black. And they weren't all slaves. And so we were telling these stories. And we would have these special weekends that we did around national holidays. And along the Columbus Day weekend happened to coincide with an annual event that took place in Williamsburg when the House of Burgesses would meet. House of Burgesses met in October and in April. So you had all of the founding fathers, you know, all of those names that you know, Washington and Jefferson and Patrick Henry, and they're coming in from all over the colony. And the colony was vast at that time, remember? It still extended all the way to the Mississippi. It was a vast colony. So people were coming into the colony, coming into Williamsburg to do the colony's business, to be the legislators that they had been elected and or appointed to be. And so because it's in April and October, the October meetings were usually when not only are they doing the government business, but they're also settling year-end debt. Settling estates. Now, for years, we had done a program at the Raleigh Tavern where these burgesses were meeting, talking about freedom, talking about the time has come for us to cut the ties with Britain. We can be our own nation. I mean, the talk is starting. So that was sort of the thing. And, you know, and several of us that were working as character interpreters, I was a director by that point, but several of us who had worked at, you know, we would be the dressing, and it was very deliberate for us to be in the space. And the irony of the visual never escaped our visitors. I mean, it was compelling because they're talking about freedom and King George wants to make a slave of us. And meanwhile, we're walking around with trays, right? You know, silently about the room. So around 1991, the program shifted a little bit because then visitors were asking us repeatedly, you know, when the program would end and the black characters would come out and the white characters would come out and they'd go their way to their next presentation. And then often we would have a presentation just in the garden there, you know, where we would talk about, did you hear what he said? Do you think that they're really going to do it? Did you hear about it? And then go into our own family business. And visitors were compelled with like, well, what did they mean they're going to say? Well, how, what are you going to do? So we started developing programming around this idea. He's got to settle his estate. He's in debt. The easiest way to get out of debt is he's going to sell his coachman and he's going to sell that boy. And he can raise X number of pounds and he's out of debt and he can go into the year fresh. So we've done that for a couple of years. And then I became director. And one of my staffers said to me, what do you want to do this year? And I said, well, you know, I'm thinking maybe the time has come. We've been doing black programming here successfully at Williamsburg now for 15 years. We've got an audience. We've got a following. People expect us. They're not, you know, weirded out by us anymore. They don't run from us anymore. They're like, oh, you know. This. So it might be time if we do it right, if we figure out how to. So we decided we were going to stage an estate sale, not a slave auction, an estate sale, so that visitors coming, because we also knew that in the public mind, when you say slave auction, they think Kunta Kinte from Roots, half-naked people being, you know, inspected and half-naked and chained up. That's the image, but that wasn't the reality. That's it happening in Norfolk, in the port cities, when, you know, fresh Africans are being brought in. But this was Virginia. This was the capital city. They were not bringing what they called freshwater Africans into their capital city. They weren't. They wanted native-born, English-speaking, know-your-job, know-your-role people in the city. Tradesmen, house people, domestic servants, etc. That's who was in the city. So we staged an estate auction. Land was going to be sold. Horses were going to be sold. Slaves were going to be sold. And they weren't sold to the public. It was a very controlled environment. It was very, very controlled environment. As most of our programming were. We never scripted what we did among the actors, but we had... we outlined what we did. We knew exactly what had to happen, when the beats were going to be, because it allowed for, it's the best improvisational theater ever, because while we had acting talent, we were historians. We knew the work. We knew the research. And we had developed how it would frame out. So we were vastly offended when people started criticizing this event, because, you know, admittedly, I got a phone call from a friend of mine in New York City who said, I just heard on the radio that you're going to be selling black people to tourists. And I said, are you kidding me? I mean, the rumors were getting so wild because of the Richmond Times-Dispatch is how it got started. No, honestly, it wasn't Rick. It wasn't Rick. But the Richmond Times-Dispatch ran a little brief editorial because, you know, we had sent out the press release on all of the activities for the weekend. There were like 20 different programs for this big full weekend. And down there towards the bottom on Saturday afternoon was a little snippet that said estate sale, land, horses, slaves to be sold to the highest bidder. And some sharp editor picked it up and wrote this brief little editorial, is Williamsburg ready for a slave auction? And that's how it started. Now, mind you, the African-American community in Williamsburg proper and our surrounding area were very familiar with their programming. I mean, many of us were their children or went to church with them or whatever. So they knew what we were doing. We talked to them. We explained how it was going to work because we knew it was different. But we wanted them to, you know, wanted to give them a heads up, especially after this thing came out. The Richmond chapter of the NAACP went ballistic and sent a delegation to Williamsburg to talk me out of it and tell me the error of my ways and that I was denigrating the history of my ancestors. Yeah. And I was much younger then, so I was less contained. Fortunately enough, when we actually did it, after all of the week of wrangling and the national news cycle, because it went national. I mean, this went international, this story. Oprah called me. We want you to come on the show, you know. Phil Donahue was still around back then. I did all the major morning networks, Good Morning America and Today Show and all this stuff talking about it. And at the heart of it was people were afraid of what they didn't know and they were making it up. And so finally I just said, you know what? Just watch it. Just shut up. Let us do it and watch what happens. And the harshest critics, after they saw it, completely changed their tune. And it really changed our business in terms of public history. Because now we could, it was like if Williamsburg does it, now we can start talking about things that are a little tougher. And it was just, it was a great thing. So that's what Rick was referring to earlier in my career, my first museum director job, and that's what I did. Actually, I helped them get Mulberry Row together because I was a part of that team that was brought in because of what we did. I mean, they were already doing the research, they were already started the archaeology, but they had no idea what to do with it. And Monticello, I love Monticello, one of my favorite places in the entire planet, but they still haven't built it. So they, you know, people were emotionally moved. You know, we had the protesters at the beginning, but once we got started, yeah, people were, you know, rooting for, that's a bad word, but we had four people that were offered for sale. One of them was the pregnant young mother, which I portrayed, because we wanted to show families split apart, but we were not going to use our juvenile performers. We had made a very clear decision that we were not going to engage children in that program. The other was her husband, so they were being separated. And the point was being made, gentlemen, you're getting two for one. You can see that she, you know. The other was being purchased by her free black husband, Matthew Ashby. Documented stuff. These free black men free black women often bought family members because that's the only way that they could ensure manumission or freedom. So we had that, and then we had a skilled tradesman, Daniel, who was a skilled carpenter being sold with his tools. And so those were the four people in the length of the program that were brought out, and we were the last ones brought out after they did all the other stuff. But yeah, people were, because, you know, again, we had framed it out. So there was competition to Matthew buying his wife. So you have someone out there going, no, I'll pay £50 for her. What, you know, and Matthew's going, I don't have, you know, so 55, you know, and it was really tense. And so the audience is going, stop, Mr. Tyler, stop, don't do it, let him buy his wife. So you had some of that. Yeah. Wow. But people ended up being very respectful and watchful of it. And I was the last one to come out because I was a director, and at that point I was not on the front lines anymore. But because of the intensity of what had happened, I chose that I could not ask my staff to do what I was not going to do. And so I took that role. And I you know, the tears that and the overflowing of emotion that came out in that character that day, it was all me. Because by that point, I was mentally exhausted from all of the interviewing and all of the stress that this had created. I was scared, and I wanted it to be right. I wanted people to feel it on a visceral level, and they did. So when it was all said and done, most of the letters and calls that I got, 90% of them, and that's no exaggeration, 90% of what I got were congratulations. And then to see the write-ups in the Washington Post and the New York Times afterwards talking about the importance of what had happened and the bravery of our crew. Because, you know, our president at the, Robert C. Wilburn was the president at the time. He could have pulled the plug on this at any time. And Bob absolutely refused. He's like, no, we are doing it. It's important. He even had donors calling him and telling him, I'm talking major donors, six and seven figure donors to the foundation saying, Bob, this is not a good idea. And Bob said, well, yes, it is, and I hope you're watching. I mean, he stood by me in ways that I will forever be grateful. This is the man, by the way, Bob Wilburn. After he left Williamsburg, he went to Gettysburg and started the Gettysburg Foundation and was responsible for the major renovation at Gettysburg of the cyclorama and the new visitor center and the partnership between the national park. He is a mentor and a friend, and I love him to this day because he stood the hard ground with us during all of that. Yes, I was told 7 o'clock, so I was trying to be sensitive to your time, but I'm good if you're good. Yes. Yes. We normally, for those kinds of programs, you know, again, there's like 20 programs in the sequence of the weekend. So any given program, we would have maybe 100 to 200 people. We had close to 3 or 4,000 that showed up. So we had to completely, so we had to really rework what we were doing. It was the first time we had wireless microphones hidden in our costumes so that people could hear us. And they literally put up wireless mics and speakers hidden in the trees. We went Disney. I mean, we had to hide speakers in the trees so that people could hear us. And because of some of the threats, we actually had to have armed, concealed weapon people interspersed in the crowd, security in the crowd, because that's the part that scared me to death. The realization of all of that when I stepped out there, and I didn't know who was out there, who was crazy, who was my protector, nothing. And I was the face of this event for 2 weeks. If nothing, I was the person. So if anybody wanted to do anything crazy, it was on me. And that's a scary place to be. Me too. But it took me, honestly and truly, it took me about 2 years to emotionally cycle through that. Because I did, after that, I did go through a phobic period where I was really afraid of crowds in public spaces, especially in closed public spaces. And this took place outside. But if I got into a room with a lot of people, I would have the worst panic attacks ever. I couldn't function. It got really bad. And I was like, okay, this is not who I am, so we need to fix this because I talk to people all the time in crowds and I need to work through that experience. And like I said, in 2 years I was pretty much good after that, but it took a while.
Is that yes. In response to threats or tweets or what?
There weren't tweets back then. It was phone calls. It was letters. Yeah, they were.
Is that dramatically changed?
Well, I don't think, you know, Williamsburg doesn't get that kind of foolishness anymore. And the job that I'm in now, I don't get threats, but I do get my share of nutties. let's be candid here. I am a rare being in the Civil War community. Number one, I'm a woman. Number two, I'm a black woman. Number three, I'm not 50. So I'm pretty much an enigma for a lot of people initially. They just don't know quite what to think or how it's going to work out. But I do occasionally get a phone call where some people say some pretty outrageous things to me. I, as early as a month ago, had a man who was very pleasant and all of that, who came into my office, and I just couldn't get over the things that he was saying to me. It was offensive to me as an American. It was offensive that there are people that would think the things that he was saying to me, and he was doing it, you know, from the core of his being. He wasn't mean. He wasn't, Yeah, he wasn't mean. He was just very matter of fact. You know, he's asking me questions, and he was, you know, he's like, well, don't you think your people would have been better off? I mean, aren't you glad that slavery happened? Because at least you learned to know what God was, and didn't you? I mean, and he was, you're laughing, ladies and gentlemen, but the fact of the matter is, there are a lot of people, there are too many people who share his opinions. And why I let him come into my office is another issue, but you know, the truth of the matter is, at the center, we deal with the Civil War from Union, Confederate, and African-American perspectives. And there is a range of emotion and sentiment and family heritage and memory that's tied up in that. And so I often meet with people who may not share we may not share the same academic perspective, but there's not all that other stuff going on. But in this case, it was absolutely stunning. And he's not rare. I mean, it happens to me, that extremity happens to me at least 5 or 6 times a year. I deal with that. Those are the ones that show up, that call. Yes?
When you were having all of the threats, were the threats from black people or from white people or from both?
I wasn't getting physical threats from black people.
No, but you had to have security. When you were
I wasn't getting physical threats from black people. What I was getting from black people was that I was a traitor, that I was a race traitor for allowing this kind of programming to take place at an institution like Colonial Williamsburg. This was not the proper place, and how dare you, and you know, you've sold us out, and I was getting that kind of stuff. Then there was this radical group of of the Young Communist Party at the College of William and Mary. Tells you right there, they were really out of touch. But their premise was, say no to racist shows, and you're helping perpetuate racial stereotype, and you're, you know. And they were loud and vocal, and they were threatening to, not physical harm, but you know, they were staging protests. And see, I grew up in Williamsburg. This is my hometown. And so I could go anywhere. I knew where stuff was. And I was listed in the phone book. So that, after that job, I did change phone, and I never became a listed person again after that incident, because they showed up at my house. They were bullying. So that was a challenge.
To give people the experience of what it would have been like,
right,
to have stood up there and been auctioned off,
right?
Denial.
And they right. Yeah. Again, when it was all said and done, even those critics were softened, and that was by the grace of God. And I will tell you that before we went out there, all of us that were involved, from the guys that were playing the auctioneers and the sheriffs and the people who were the slaves, we all got together in a big old circle in the back of the building, and we're like, okay, y'all, this is it. Huddle up. And we said a big prayer, and we said, Lord, guide our tongues, guide our steps. We want to teach. And we went out there, and we did. And it was an amazing, you know, God put his hand on that thing, and he settled it right on down.
Were they ever able to do it again?
No. No. I think it's one of those, they did a lot of other things which were really amazing and powerful. But then, in my opinion, Williamsburg went through, not because I left, but Williamsburg went through what I consider a creative drought. Actually, the vice president before the one that they have now that runs the historic area, when he left, during his term, they came up with this thing called Revolutionary City, you know, which was really, really very good programmatically. But economic struggles, crisis, they started consolidating, and they started eliminating specialization. So now people who punched your ticket were now going to be actors? Really? You know, I mean, or people who were, you know, your strongest character interpreters who did this work we're now going to have to punch tickets in front of buildings because we just didn't have the staffing. And so what happened, again, the combination of those things, in my view, vastly changed the quality of the programming there. It's still good. Is it innovative to me? The innovation is happening at that organization in the digital world, not in the, on the ground. They're doing amazing things digitally, but not on the ground. Yes?
Back to the Emancipation Proclamation.
Do you mind if I sit down? Because I've been on my feet all day. I'm actually on vacation. I don't know if Rick told y'all that. I've been on vacation this week, but today I had an interview with a graduate student who wanted to talk about, she's doing her thesis on the slave auction and public history, which was kind of remarkable. So she tracked me down and she wanted to interview me for that. So I did that this morning, left there, went to a speaking engagement where I was a keynote this afternoon, and then had another meeting with architects because we're building new facilities at Tredegar. And then I left there at 4:30 and came straight to you. So you all have made my night. I have to tell you, you're wonderful, wonderful being with you thus far. So now your question on Emancipation Proclamation.
I just heard a talk by the writer of Man on the Mountain about Jefferson and
yeah.
Why he never freed his slaves.
Right.
And the writer's argument is that it was because he couldn't afford to. It was an economic decision.
Correct.
To what degree did Lincoln look into the economic problems of freeing slaves?
He did a little, but he did a little. In one of the earlier schemes of his administration, there was talk about compensation. Even in the first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation, there was talk of compensating over time owners. And again, the radical parts of his party said, absolutely not. You don't pay evil. You don't pay. That was their impression. So yes, there were considerations of all of that. And he wanted to, okay, let's get this emancipation piece done. Then we can figure out how we rebuild or reconstruct the South. And so, and that process began in fits and starts. But the biggest rebuilding of the South really occurs under Woodrow Wilson's administration and then during the World War II era, when you get these huge naval facilities and military facilities that are built throughout the South, when the Federal Reserve starts placing its central banks, they are deliberately setting them in places that need the stimulus. So there is a consideration of what happened. But, you know, I mean, immediately after war, people are starving. I mean, it was a horrible thing. And that what people went through is what added to the bitterness, I think. It was horrible. Oh, yeah, it was horrible. You know, the money wasn't worth anything. People had hoarded the money. I mean, it was absolutely valueless, you know. I mean, there was a bread riot in Richmond in the summer of 63. The women went on riot in the streets of Richmond. And these aren't poor women that are rioting in the street because things had gotten so bad. So, but anyway, he gave some consideration, but it didn't fly with his larger political issues that he had to address. I think our last question. Yes, ma'am.
I was just curious as to how, when you were, this is going back to your estate sale,
mm-hmm.
how did you feel standing up there when they were auctioning you or selling you personally?
Well, like I said, I mean, at the moment of it all, it was the perfect venue for me to release everything. There's video out there, I think, in the YouTube world of it. And I just literally broke down in audible, loud sobbing, just weeping. And it was great, because I got it all out. I hadn't been able to do any of it, you know. I mean, for 2 weeks, I was the face of an organization. And I'd only been a director for a month when this happened. So it was tremendous pressure. And I was trying to plan a wedding, you know. It was a big old mess. And my, you know, ex-husband, but at that time, the love of my life, you know, he didn't, you know, the good news is he was an actor too. So he understood what was happening, and he was very supportive in that process. But he'd never, the time that we had dated and all that, he had never ever seen me cry, only on the stage. But he knew that day, he's like, oh my God. You know, that's something else that he'd never seen before. And so it was the past, present, and the future clashing in a moment in my soul is what it was. It was certainly emotions about doing this for my ancestors, for people to understand their experiences. It was in the moment of all of the stuff that I was dealing with, and it was the future of my business. It was the future of our public history institutions. If this fails, people will never take a shot at looking at some of our less pleasant history again if we fail at this. So it was the collusion of all of that for me. So those sobs were just as real as they can get. And it worked in the moment, and it was a part of the calming. It was part of the release, and it was part of the authenticity of the moment. And I don't think we would have ever been able to recreate that again. It was a special thing, and I don't think we ever could recreate. And I wasn't prepared to do it again. And that's the other thing. Remember, I said in the beginning, I told my staff, I'm not going to let you do something that I'm not willing to do. I wasn't willing to go through it again. And by the time that I was gone. I had a new job, and I was off to Detroit. You know, so thank you all so much for your hospitality, your generosity. Absolutely wonderful.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.